Thank you. My talk's going to differ a little bit in that I'm not talking about a specific type of injury. It's going to be talking about the broader issue of advocacy in injury and violence in the United States. I don't have any relationships to disclose, and unfortunately don't have any funders to disclose either. Our objectives here were really to look at the experience that injury and violence prevention researchers had in advocacy and the different barriers they might have encountered if they had wanted to do advocacy, and then also what kind of training and technical assistance needs that they might have. And so I'm sure most of you are familiar with injury and violence being a major cause of death in the United States. And for those of you who don't know, that's New Mexico, where I'm from, and of course we're up there every year either having the highest or second highest rates of injury death in the country. So when we look at what the benefits of injury and violence prevention research are in general, we're really talking about creating the evidence base for the different programs and policy strategies that are out there. And we can use those to inform the policymakers and the people, the practitioners who are going to be implementing programs in their communities. Some of this research is also used to look at cost effectiveness, and that's with, especially if any of you have read Ted Miller's work, he does a lot in this area of looking at the cost of injury and what we get back from prevention mechanisms and strategies in the community. And I just put up some of the things that injury and violence research have looked at and how they can save lives. And we've seen a lot of this in the area of motor vehicle crashes with child safety seats and the earlier talk on helmets. Unfortunately, we're one of the states that doesn't have a motorcycle helmet law currently. Booster seats, ignition interlock devices for drunk driving. So those are all things around motor vehicle injury that have been shown to work and in a lot of places have been implemented either as programs or as policies. Cure Violence is a Chicago-based violence prevention program that has been shown to work. It was formerly called Ceasefire. And then there are comprehensive falls prevention programs for older adults, things like Tai Chi programs that have been shown to work. And in the area of poisoning prevention, child-resistant packaging is an example of something that's evidence-based and has saved a lot of lives. But so we often run into, so why should injury researchers be looking at advocacy? And for those of you who have been involved for a little while, and at Chapel Hill I was involved in putting together the core competencies for injury and violence prevention, and advocacy is one of those things that are considered necessary for injury and violence prevention professionals. And it really is something where we can inform and improve population health by providing this information both to the media, to policymakers, to other professionals, and to the public. And there's often concern about the issue of advocacy versus lobbying, and I do want to emphasize I'm not talking about lobbying your congressman for a specific bill. This is talking about educating and informing legislators, policymakers, and the media and the public, providing them with information so they can make informed decisions. So the methods that we used, we had a cross-sectional electronic survey. It had 17 questions on it and took about 10 minutes to complete. It was pretty quick and easy. I guess unless you had a tremendous amount of advocacy experience, it could have taken a while longer. But it was developed by experts in the field of public policy as well as injury prevention. And these were people we pulled from on the SAVOR Policy and Advocacy Committee. And our questions covered the individual's experience with 16 different types of advocacy activities, and then their interest in pursuing those different types of activities, as well as the barriers that they had encountered and their training experience, previous trainings they had been exposed to, and their training needs. And it was administered over a four-week period in the spring of 2010. We did pre-test the survey among a small number of injury professionals that were not members of SAVOR. And then the population that we administered the survey to were all the members of SAVOR, and they were recruited through the membership listserv. The responses could be submitted anonymously by the participants, but they were also given the opportunity to provide contact information if they didn't mind having follow-up from the policy committee about certain issues. And this was exempted, the study was exempted through our IRB at the University of New Mexico. So for the data analysis, we did basic descriptive statistics with some chi-square for the dichotomous variables and a spearmint rank correlation coefficients for the ordinal variables and used the standard statistical significance of 0.05. So our results, we had 72 respondents, which is a small n, except that is over half of the membership of SAVER. So I'll also put in a recruitment if you want to become a member of SAVER. We would welcome you. So half the members responded, which for an electronic survey isn't bad. The majority, vast majority of them did report that they're either their primary or secondary affiliation was with a university. But we found that people were affiliated with a lot of different other professional organizations, which any of you working in injury know that we all come from different backgrounds and are working on different issues. And so there were people who might, actually APHA was the biggest second membership that people had in the ICEHS section, and also organizations like Safe States, or organizations that were specific to sports-related injury or fire and burn injury, those kinds of things. And then we also had 11 respondents that were members of medical societies like American Academy of Pediatrics or the Society for Academic Emergency Medicine. So the 16 different things we asked about, it was a variety of different types of experience that people could have had, and it was broader than just injury. So we asked about unintentional injury, we asked about violence, we asked about other injury, which the majority of those included things like just the general field of injury or funding or those kind of things, and then just other advocacy experience. So some of these could have been not within the field of injury prevention. And so the top things that people had experience with, more than half of our respondents had been subject matter experts on different areas of injury and violence prevention or another area if they were asked for that. And then half of them had written their legislator about an issue. And then serving as a coalition member or a committee member were also on there, and then attending the policy briefing. So those were the top five things that people had participated in. And down at the bottom of the list were people who had actually worked on congressional briefings or people who had called into radio and television shows to express their opinion about an issue. And when we separated out and just wanted to look at the unintentional injury and violence, we saw the same top five things came out, although in different rank orders, with policy briefings ranking higher among those who were interested in violence prevention compared with unintentional injury. And just in general, unintentional injury had a lot more, or individuals had a lot more experience with advocacy in unintentional injury than with violence. So when we look at the interest, so we were talking about their experience with it, and now this is what are people interested in doing. And their interests, three of the top five, or in the slide, the bottom five, the three with the highest reported interest, some of them we had seen before, the writing a legislator or serving as a subject matter expert or attending a briefing. But what we found is two things, though, providing testimony and visiting a legislator, were things that people did not have much experience with but were really interested in doing. So we did find a correlation between the number of activities that people reported doing and their interest in advocacy, which you would expect. And the most frequently reported topics were issues around motor vehicle safety, and those could be motorcycle helmets, I know was on there, booster seats was on there. And then violence prevention was the second most common response or issues involved in violence prevention. Some people reported barriers, and the most common among those was having limited time, and then also the lack of institutional support, which isn't surprising if most people are affiliated with universities where your promotion is based on the grants you've written and the papers you've written, then you don't get much backing from your institution to be an advocate. There were also some respondents who indicated employer restrictions on their ability to be advocates and lack of training. And then we had one person who said that they had been involved in previous efforts that weren't successful and that had so discouraged them that they weren't interested in doing it anymore, which is kind of sad. Anybody who's been involved in policy knows it takes a long time to get it accomplished. When we looked at training, we found that about two-thirds of people were interested in participating in future training activities and learning both in trainings themselves and in receiving or finding out about getting some technical assistance. And only about one-third of them had had previous training. And some of those went back to the 80s, so it had been a while since the training had occurred. We didn't find any correlation between prior training and the interest in advocacy. So even if so, people who hadn't, regardless of your training, people were interested in advocacy, but the training was associated with having participated in advocacy in the past. When we looked at specific technical assistance needs, people were asking for advocacy do's and don'ts, what they were supposed to do. And I think, again, this gets around the sensitivity of people being afraid of crossing a line into lobbying, and so wanting to be sure of what they should be doing and what they shouldn't be doing. And then there were also areas, a lot of written materials, fact sheets. The written materials by itself is just when people wrote other written materials and specified something else. Summary data, background data, issue briefs, so all of those different written materials, as well as web links to where they could find data around certain issues. And when we asked how people would want to get their training, most people preferred a webinar, and then we found after that pre-conference workshops, and then coaching versus a conference call. I know if any of you have worked with Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, they actually have a really good setup for coaching individuals to talk about the work that they're doing and having arranging for them to make Hill visits. And then in-person workshops and other face this at is at the person's location. So would you want to have a workshop in your office around advocacy? And then other face-to-face, so workshops that were set up but were not attached to any other conference fell in at the last. Some of the limitations, of course, you can have recall bias. We were asking people about activities they had done over the last 2 years, and so you may have some bias if you're dealing with people like me who can't remember what they had for lunch yesterday. And then response rate, it was 53%, which is greater than a lot of surveys, but it still leaves a lot of room for people for bias, because the people who had responded might be more interested and have participated more in advocacy than the people who didn't. And then this was only SAVR representatives, members, and so we know this doesn't represent all injury researchers that are out there. And our focus, and this was something that I guess was just neglectful on our part, that as we developed the survey, we had some of the questions on there that were around your congressman, and so we had people from Canada who wrote notes to us saying we don't have congressmen, and so we hadn't really been thinking. We have people from New Zealand, and I don't even know what I think they have a parliamentary democracy there, but so there was that was inconsiderate on our part, I guess, as we were going through. We hadn't considered the few members of SAVR that are international. They could answer the majority of questions around the types of activities and their interests, but then there were some specific questions on their Congress members. And that was a oversight on our part. The conclusions were that we know that advocacy is a core competency for injury and violence professionals, even if all of our members may not know that. And a majority of researchers are interested in doing advocacy for the field or for a specific injury or violence research area. A majority of them had also done at least one advocacy activity over the past 2 years, but they did voice their concerns about barriers, especially at the institutional level, and having time, which are interrelated. Only a third of them reported they had ever been trained in advocacy before, and as I said, some of those were a long time ago. And we really think that different professional organizations like SAVR and ICEHS, which was one of the places cited when people were asked where they had gotten their advocacy training, and ICEHS was one of the groups that was cited as having provided that. So organizations like ours can really assist researchers, especially when you look at things like time, that if we can develop the materials people need and have those readily accessible through our websites, that will make it much easier for people to be able to advocate. And the same thing with training. Some of the specific quotes around training, people really felt that they look at their congresspersons as being like up on a pedestal and somebody they couldn't really relate to. And so the idea of actually being able to be trained and figure out how they can go and talk to a congressperson, either at the state level or at the national level, was something there was a lot of interest in. And these are things that we are trying to address through SAVR this year. We calendar year, since it's coming to an end, but this coming year in June at the SAVR conference, we'll actually be having a Hill Day on the Tuesday before the conference. And so there'll be a training for members, and then we'll be going to visit different members on the Hill. And that's going to be in conjunction with Safe States. I don't know if we're actually like traveling on the same bus, but they'll be doing the same thing during that week. And then also with trying to provide materials for the field in general, I don't know how many of you have seen, but over the past few months we developed some information on the sequestration process and what that would mean to the field. And Safe States did the same thing. And then on the policy subcommittee, we worked on that to have a companion one that would be for SAVR and why injury research in general is important for the field. And so we are working on those, but there's a lot of work to be done. I'd like to acknowledge some of the other people who worked with us on the Advocacy and Policy Subcommittee. And at the time of the survey, Mike Mello was the president of SAVR, and he's the one who facilitated administering the survey. And for those of you who've never been to Albuquerque during October, we have a balloon fiesta where they have more than 700 hot air balloons. Occasionally people fall out, which we might need to do some research on that. But it's a beautiful time of year and a beautiful city. And I think we have 1.5 minutes for questions if anybody has any.